Kuzuzangpo, hello to everyone around the world, and particularly Kuzuzangpo to Lama Pelden Dolma. Such a pleasure to see you. We have never met before, but it's a great honor for me to meet you virtually and hope we will meet in person in the near future. So, in our Buddha nature resource and also the teachings of many sort of Buddhist masters, you find this very important point that compassion is an integral part of our nature, that our true nature is a combination of clarity, openness, and compassion. Most of us in the frenzy of our ordinary life, we do not necessarily always exhibit these qualities. And we are caught in the maze of our delusions instead of clarity, in the thicket of views and prejudices instead of openness, and in the trap of sort of self-centricity instead of love and compassion. Mm-hmm. But you have been following the traditions which bring out this lucid, open, and all-embracing nature of the mind, and practicing many spiritual techniques to make these qualities manifest. More importantly, you have also been spending a lot of time trying to apply these in practice to help reduce mental illness in the world through bringing the otherwise sort of profound esoteric practices into psychotherapy and counseling. And I think even here in Bhutan, we are now talking a lot about mental health. It is becoming a very serious challenge, and particularly the digital revolution has brought sort of unprecedented challenges in terms of disciplining the mind. Our minds have become much more restless and distracted. And then this COVID pandemic has really brought a great deal of trauma to a lot of people, and we are yet to overcome it. So it's so urgent to talk about mental health issues and spiritual practice. And of all people, it's such a great honor to have you with all your expertise and experience to sort of share with us your wisdom and insights and advices on these challenges, how to face these challenges. But before we get into these sort of deep Buddha nature and mental health issues, I would like to ask you how you first encountered Buddhist teachings, particularly the teachings associated with Buddha nature. If you can sort of share with us your spiritual journey and tell us a bit about your experience.
Oh, an honor to meet you, Kempa La, and an honor to be here with Sadra Foundation. These teachings are so close to my heart, Buddha nature. So when Marcus asked me to come, I was quite shy because I'm not a great scholar or anything, but he felt that it was worthwhile to have me even though I'm not a scholar. So I'll try my best to be of benefit here today to the people that are interested in this topic. So it's true that I've tried to really bring forth in a practical manner and experiential manner. So as a small child, I saw the suffering of the world. And I remember when I was like 3 years old going to church, and I thought, oh, maybe this is where people get more real. And I thought there was something that had to be more real going on to address the suffering. And I actually had an experience that I never thought of as Buddha nature, but much, much later, after I had a lot of Buddhist training, I thought back and I thought that was an experience of Buddha nature when I was quite small, when I was 3 years old. And I was with my grandmother one day, and I was sitting in her garden with her, and we were speaking about maybe taking a trip to the Far East, to China. And we were sitting in her beautiful garden, and all of a sudden I lost ordinary consciousness, and my whole consciousness just turned into light, into a ball of light. My consciousness actually then lost all sense of form, and it went up through these seven spheres, seven balls of light, and just came out the top, and then just went into open space, just simple awareness. And then I just fell off my chair, kind of. And then my grandma said, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And of course, I was completely okay, because it was such a liberated experience of openness, luminosity, and clarity. But I thought, oh, my grandma's not going to understand this. So I just said, "Yes, yes, I'm okay. I'm okay." And I just never talked about it ever to anybody. No. Until I was in three-year retreat, and I asked my teacher, why did I have this experience, you know? So I think then later, the first time I ever encountered the teachings on Buddha nature was when I was with Kala Rinpoche. And one day we were with him, studying with him. And in the first place, I met Kala Rinpoche because a friend — I wasn't a Buddhist at all. I had studied in Zen Buddhism and Sufism and mystical Christianity, and I'd been doing extensive yoga, sitting Zazen, and I was very interested in spirituality and trying to purify myself, because I felt like I needed a huge amount of purification, because I was feeling so much of all my shadows and everything. And a friend dragged me off to meet this old Tibetan Lama. And I had been praying very extensively to meet my guru. I was 25 years old. And finally, I went to meet this old Tibetan Lama. And as soon as I saw him, I knew that was my teacher. So I thought, well, whatever religion he is, that's good enough for me. And that was Kala Rinpoche. So then I thought, okay, well, he's my teacher. So he said, if you want to come study in my monastery, you can come. So about some months later, I just left everything behind and I went to Darjeeling to study with him in his monastery. So we were taking teachings, you know, three times a week from him and the other Boka Rinpoche and the Kenpo there. And one day Kala Rinpoche, he took his Zen and he just wrapped it all around, and underneath he had this crystal, and he wrapped the crystal in many layers of his Zen. And he mentioned that, like you were saying, there were many, many layers of like conflicting emotions and all kinds of different considerations. And he said these were like the layers of the onion, and all these layers of the Zen were wrapped around the crystal. And as he peeled away the layers of his Zen, which for people that don't know, it's this thing that monks and nuns and lamas wear, this maroon garment as an upper garment. And as he peeled that away, he said, that's what the Dharma does. It peels away the layers of the onion that are the obscurations to our Buddha nature. And at the end, he just had this pure crystal that he held up in his hand. And he said, that's our Buddha nature. That's our true nature, that is luminous clarity and compassion and wisdom. And that's at the heart of who we truly are. And he said, that's what the Dharma is. It helps us unveil who we truly are. So that was my first teaching on Buddha nature from Kala Rinpoche.
Extraordinary. Well, I was quite envious. You are so fortunate to have these very powerful sort of experiences. I mean, a lot of people actually don't quite know what is Buddha nature or whether their life is meant for such practice. But you, at three, you had that extraordinary experience. And then certainly met the right teacher, and you could immediately recognize that person to be your teacher. How fortunate. And you, earlier you were saying that you're not a great scholar, but you know, the true knowledge is really knowledge from experience, as the Buddhists would value. So it's really raw experience you're sharing here. And the Kagyu tradition especially Marpa Kagyu tradition that I am familiar with, is considered as a tradition or a transmission of experiences. Can you say that is the same or that also applies to the Shangpa Kagyu tradition that you have taken up primarily as your school of practice. Can you share a little bit about the Shangpa Kagyu tradition for our audience?
Yes, Kempola. Kala Rinpoche was the holder, not the primary, of course, holder of the Kagyu and the Marpa Kagyu, but he was sent to the West by Karmapa and also requested by His Holiness Dalai Lama, both of them, to come to the West as a representative of the Kagyu tradition. So in our three-year retreat, we had to do, or we were fortunate to do, both the Kagyu and the Shampa, although we did the entire Shampa tradition, and we were not able to do the entire Kagyu, but we did do the Naro Chudruk and Dorje Palmo, and we did a number, including Mila, practice and various other Kagyu practices. So I was also trained in, and I did the Karma Kagyu Nundro, et cetera. So I was also trained in the Kagyu. So this is also very, very close to my heart. And so Kala Rinpoche, although he was trained as a Kempo as well, a scholar, and he was a great scholar, he always emphasized practice to us very much. And his training to his personal students was that we should emphasize experience first and practice first. So that's why his students, a lot of us are not so trained in scholarly, but we're more trained in practice. And he was emphasizing the three-year retreats. And of course, Sadra has really helped on the scholarly side, and that came through the efforts of some of his students as well. So it's balanced out. But yeah, so I'm very close with the Kagyu as well. And also, I did end up studying extensively with Kempo Sotron Jamsa Rinpoche, who is a great scholar, and emphasized both practice and scholarship, and is one of the primary Kagyu scholars as well. So that really helped me also, because through practice and then later studying more in the scholarly, although, I can't remember any of it, but it helped me to understand from the scholarly point of view also. And I very much think that it's a huge strength and contribution of the Vajrayana tradition to Buddhism in general, that the scholarship and the practice go together in our tradition. And I think that's a really big asset. And especially in the West, because I find in the West that the philosophy tends to get very muddied. And the fact that it's so rigorous in both, in the Vajrayana tradition, I think is a tremendous help for the West.
I think it'd be good to talk about the Shangpa, particularly, when you look at the history of the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions, you have many founding fathers. And in the Shangpa, I find that you have founding mothers instead of founding fathers, with Niguma and Sukhasiddhi, these people being the lead figures. And it's so actually fitting that you are also now a prominent teacher of the Shangpa tradition. So how do you find that? What's your take on this? I like it a lot, because all other traditions, especially if you look at the Marpa Kagyu, you have a hierarchy. It's a very patriarchal lineage.
Yes. So, Kala Rinpoche was such a traditional old man when he taught extensively and around the world. And yet he was actually a radical in disguise, because he was the first person to put Westerners in three-year retreat, and he was the first person to make women lamas. So he was quite radical. And he also was the primary holder, as you know, of this woman, this female lineage that is extremely rare. Of course, we have the Chud lineage that came from Machik Labdun, a woman, but the Shampa was the only full and complete lineage, which held two lineages of the six yogas. So both It came from two women, as you mentioned, the Sukha city in Nguma, and behind me is a Tonka of Nguma, who is a dark-skinned woman to boot. And both she and Sukha city were from Kashmir in the 10th, 11th century. And they were fully awakened and met Vajradhara Dorji Tong themselves and became fully enlightened and passed on not only a full six yoga system themselves. So within Vajrayana, there's only three full six yoga systems, the Naro, the Nigyu from Nguma, the Naro from Naropa that came through the Kagyu, and then the Sukha city six yogas. So two of those systems are held by the Shampa, as well as two full tantric systems of Yiram. And that are Judy Lana and Demchok Lana, and then a number of other very in-depth practices. So there's, of course, the Shampa, then I chose in my center when I founded it and called it Sukha City Foundation to emphasize the Shampa, because many of us who've practiced the Shampa tradition really fell in love with it. The simplicity of the Dakini teachings really spoke to our Western hearts. You know, growing up in such a complex society, I think the simplicity of the Dakini teachings just was really like nectar and medicine to us. They're much more pith instructions and much more, or let's say they're much less wordy than the male teachings, and much more just pith instructions and very to the point. They're very much like Mahamudra Dzogchen instructions. They're very to the point. So we really love them a lot. And so it's been my great honor and pleasure to be one of the people spreading the Shampa teachings. And also, as you know from my book, Love on Every Breath, that Nguma had a very unusual, special form of Tonglen that she taught that I believe is very helpful for our world at this time, both psychologically and spiritually, to help really heal people's hearts and psyches. That is a Tonglen where you start with yourself, which is a very profound way to heal the psychological things that are going on inside of us nowadays. So that's really, I think, incredibly a special gift that comes down to us from 1,000 years ago. And it was never really taught publicly, all these Shampa teachings. It was handed down in the retreats, in the cave retreats, up until now when it's finally coming out into the world. And that was a decision of Kala Rinpoche's to bring this out into the world at this time, these special Dakini teachings.
Yeah, so you mentioned your book, which I enjoyed thoroughly, Love on Every Breath. Thank you for such wonderful work. And when you talk about this practice on Tonglen, which is giving out happiness and taking in suffering, but you discuss a great deal about the philosophical underpinning of this practice, and you touch on Buddha nature, and in fact, you write, who we truly are is luminosity, clarity, and emptiness. Who we truly are is the inseparable union of wisdom and love. So it seems the tradition of Tonglen from Nguma is very deeply embedded in the theory or philosophy of Buddha nature. Can you elaborate a bit on how this is?
Yes, I think the extraordinary Tonglen of Nguma is so powerful, especially for right now, because it really focuses first on starting the Tonglen from bringing forth and resting in our own Buddha nature before you start the Tonglen. And this really brings so much emotion to me, because let me back up a little bit first, Kempo Lada, to say that I feel very strongly that it's a teacher's role and duty to help bring forth our students' Buddha nature. I think what I felt from my teachers was when I didn't believe in myself at all, when I couldn't contact my own Buddha nature, I felt that my teachers believed in me and they mirrored to me my own Buddha nature. They saw my own Buddha nature in me and they mirrored that to me. Through seeing it in me, they helped me feel that. And I think that that is what a good teacher does, whether they're Buddhist, Christian, Sufi, Hindu, Jewish, you know, Native American, a shamanistic, whoever they are, a good spiritual teacher sees the pure being, the true wisdom and love in their student and mirrors that back to them. They see the actual, you know, true nature in their student and reflects that to them. Mirroring them back is a psychological term, but we could say, you know, shows that back to them, reflects that back to them. And I think this, I experienced this from all my great teachers, Kala Rinpoche, 16th Karmapa, Jangan Khontro Rinpoche, Dujum Rinpoche, Dingo Kenzi, Dalai Lama, you know, Kempo Sotron Boka Rinpoche, Sitju Rinpoche, all of my great teachers, I felt that and feel that to this day, whether they're embodied or not embodied on the Nirmanakaya, on the human plane. And I really feel this is the primary role of a teacher to do this, as well as speaking the words and teaching the Dharma. And I think it's through this process that's a very one-to-one direct transmission, as well as in a room of students, that it's how the student comes to have faith in themselves and in their own true nature. And then in the teachings, we do the practices as a student that, you know, and we learn the Dharma that helps us to peel away the layers of the onion that are keeping us from directly experiencing that, as you were mentioning earlier. And then in Nyingma's Tonglen, you focus by first calling on Chenrezig Avalokiteshvara, you know, who is the embodiment of awakened love and compassion, you know, awakened in that he is an awakened bodhisattva, you know, the embodiment of all wisdom. And then praying to him that we can embody awakened love, you know, like that, like he does, and having him dissolve into ourselves and then reside in our heart chakra. And this helps us to get in touch with that in ourselves, because we imagine him in our heart. We imagine that the awakened love of all the Buddhas is in our heart. And we imagine that the Vajra-like nature of awakened love that is deathless, that is the true nature of who we are. So we imagine that this Buddha nature is appearing like a Vajra, inseparable wisdom and awakened love in our hearts. And you know, what Vajrayana practice does, as you know, is we imagine ourselves into the actuality. So by imagining that Buddha nature is there, we slowly over time begin to actually get in touch with the reality that it is there. And the heart chakra, for people who aren't aware of Vajrayana practice, who are listening to this, the heart chakra is the easiest gateway into Buddha nature. It is the gateway for us. That's the easiest way to access it. It's not, you know, Buddha nature is everywhere, but it's easiest to tap into it through the heart chakra. So in Vajrayana practice, it's used as a gateway. So Nyingma has us imagine this crystal, luminous, of course it's empty, but imagined as a crystal Vajra of light there. And then we anchor in that, and through a series of meditations, we open to feeling our Buddha nature there as this Vajra of light. as the essence of Chenrezi, awakened love, before we start the Tonglen. And so that when we're breathing in the suffering, it's, we're feeling that all the Buddha's love and compassion, not just our own, you know, self hampered by ego's love and compassion is transforming the suffering, but all the awakened love of the Buddhas is transforming the suffering. And then this lightning bolt goes out from the Vajra that has transformed the suffering, and the joy and the love all goes into the person. So I think this was, you know, obviously she was called a wisdom Dakini, a fully awakened Dakini in human form. And I think this is very powerful for people nowadays to help. And I found that for me, it helped hugely to help me get in touch with my Buddha nature, which had been, you know, even though I had that experience at three, it got completely clouded over. I got completely out of touch with it, totally was immersed in my own shadow material. And, you know, took a long time to help uncover that through my guru's blessing, you know. So that practice, I feel, is one of the jewels of the Shampa teachings.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing that. And of course, those who want to get into more detail, Love on Every Breath is a wonderful book. It's so brilliantly laid out for anyone to practice it so easily. I have a few questions for you, Lama. And this Tonglen practice that you present that has come down from Nyingma is so brilliantly expedient, I would say. It's sort of... uses the Tonglen from the Bodhisattva practice and then synthesizes it with the Vajrayana practice of visualization and transformation and mantras and so forth. So it's really very effective and powerful, I think. But the first step in the practice is really to, as you said, to get in touch with our Buddha nature. And that involves really sort of seeing openness and the emptiness of freeing one's mind from any kind of preconceptions, prejudices, biases, sort of to totally empty the mind. And I know Chekawa Ishidorji, who is the other great master promoting Tonglen, he does with his presentation of the ultimate bodhicitta of realizing emptiness. Here you have this first step of getting in touch with Buddha nature. But when you take this practice to people who are not familiar with Buddhist philosophy or who are not familiar with Buddhism in general, do you find it difficult to sort of even relate this first practice to them? Do you get reactions where people don't actually get the first step itself?
Well, I also start with the complete emptiness, openness, and letting go of everything and just resting in open awareness. And then with people that are not familiar at all, I either say to have the Vajra of light or just a sphere of light, like just a small ball of light. But no, I've taught to all kinds of people and they relate completely to it. They really love it. And I've even taught with the bishop of our cathedral in San Francisco, the Episcopal Cathedral, and he very much loves it. And he wanted me to teach it to his people for climate change and everything. And a lot of people really related to it. Even in the South, there was, in the Southern United States, people learned it and they very much liked it. So I found the opposite actually, but I gave them the option of not just a Vajra, but a sphere of light. And they liked it very much. And I gave them the option of instead of Chenrezi, and I learned these options from Kala Rinpoche actually. Mm-hmm. He also would adapt for priests and different people to their own religion. He said like they could adapt for their own religion. So I gave him the option of having Jesus instead of Chenrezi. So Kala Rinpoche told us that was okay. So I give that option. So Kala Rinpoche said like that, so I also gave the option.
Wonderful. And also one of the questions or curiosity that I have is when you take this to people as a psychotherapeutic practice, and you come across a lot of people who don't even believe that we are good by nature. Now, people believe we are sort of by nature egocentric, you know, the selfish genes and so forth. So it's quite difficult to convince people that we are loving and compassionate by nature. Do you come across people like that? And how do you convince them when you come across such people?
Well, I'm quite shy. So usually people only come to me for counseling because I'm a lama, usually. So they already come that thinking that there is compassion. So usually, and when I worked in community mental health, then, you know, I would tread slowly. I walk slowly, you know, and I would only give things that people were open to, because I'm a quite shy person, so I only give things if people are open. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So, but I think, you know, it's really funny. Like one time I was in the hospital and I found like all the nurses were like so wonderful. And there was one nurse that was very grouchy, but I saw on her name tag, her name was Angela, which of course means angel. And so, but she was very grouchy and all the other nurses were so loving that they were like, kind of like angels, you know, but she was named Angela, but she was so grouchy. So, but then I just started talking to her and after a little bit, she turned out to be the most loving of all of them, you know? So I think it's like the Dalai Lama says, if you approach people with loving kindness, a lot of times they turn out to be quite nice mm-hmm. in the end. They kind of melt if you approach with a lot of kindness, but not forcing them to anything. I think forcing people is the wrong thing. Just approach them on the ground where they are. But also I admire people like, there was a fellow who joined the Ku Klux Klan, which is a very racist, uptight organization in America. And he went in for many years and then he changed the mind of like five of their leaders and they all quit being Ku Klux Klan because after some years, and I could not do that, but I very, very much admire him.
Wonderful. And you come across people who, I've come across some people who would actually be quite scared of taking other people's suffering onto oneself. Not only that, you know, some people will believe, why should I even care? Why should I even take the suffering on me? But others, even if they really want to, they'll be so scared that, you know, they fear the real suffering coming onto them. So in this respect, the Niguma practice of sort of transforming suffering by touching the crystal vajra is very powerful. But the other thing that I found interesting is also doing Tonglen for oneself, okay? Self-love, yes. By visualizing yourself in front of you. Yeah, how has that come to be? Because I haven't come across this kind of Tonglen in any other traditions that I've studied.
Yes, and you know, in the book, Ken MacLeod, originally translated from Jamgon Kontro Lodro Thai, he gives Nagumas Tonglen in there as well. And the Great Path of Awakening, I think it's translated the title as, but so Jamgon Kontro Lodro Thai, you know, gave Nagumas Tonglen in there. And it starts like that. And that was our retreat instructions, the oral instructions from Naguma. So it's very profound. And this is the hardest thing for people to do in the West. The hardest thing of this whole practice is for people to do for themselves. And I firmly believe as a psychotherapist that, and what I've seen in students is that our love and compassion goes much deeper and we are able to eventually become much more compassionate for others if we can become compassionate for ourselves. But this is the most difficult part for people in the West. And true compassion for the self is extremely different than selfishness. It's a totally different thing. So I usually advise students to do at least 3 to 6 months self-compassion before they start doing the extensive practice for others, you know. So to spend most of the session on themselves and then just part of the session for others. And that is so difficult for people. They really come up against a lot of resistance for it, because it's, like I said, it's just completely different than selfishness. It's very huge resistance. All the way people feel they're unworthy, they judge themselves, they feel guilty, and all of these things. And my Buddhist teachers, all of them told us that guilt is a very destructive emotion and that we have to work through that and let go of it. And doubt about yourself and all of these things, they're very particularly strong in the West. And as His Holiness Dalai Lama said, self-hatred is very, very strong in the West. And he didn't find that that was in the Tibetan people. And so there's a lot of strong psychological things in the West that make it very difficult for people to do this self-compassion. So I think these particular emotions are what block the Buddha nature from ourself being able to get in contact with it. And so they have to be worked through in order to really authentically experience Buddha nature, because a narcissism is closely related with not being able to experience the Buddha nature. And narcissism is related with selfishness, and it's actually maybe too complicated to get involved with right now in this discussion, but insecurity and self-doubt are related with narcissism. It's like you would think the opposite, but somebody who's very insecure actually will often become narcissistic. It's the flip side of it. So this is a, you know, quite extensive discussion. But these kinds of things like self-doubt, insecurity, self-hatred are extremely important to work through in terms of being authentically able to get in touch with one's true nature. So in terms of doing the Tonglen for oneself, this is very, very important. And so Nagumo, I think, saw all this in her enlightened perspective, her enlightened seeing about. And obviously this was an issue back in India in 1000, you know, the 11th century, you know, 10th, 11th century, or she wouldn't have seen this and put this in the practice.
Yeah. Can you explain a little more about how this practice of Tonglen towards oneself could actually help narcissistic tendencies?
Well, to me, yeah. So when you feel, when there's no self-love, when you feel tremendously insecure and you have no authentic sense of self, narcissism is built on a feeling of emptiness, but the wrong kind of emptiness, an inauthentic sense of self in a psychological sense. So, you know, you may have heard people say that in order to let go of self, you need to have like a healthy sense of self. Have you ever heard that? So
no.
There has to be kind of like, to really tread the spiritual path takes a tremendous amount of courage and stamina. And that requires a healthy self. In narcissism, there is not a healthy self. There's a very, very insecure sense of self. When there's a very insecure sense of self, that's because there was not, you know, like there's an empty sense of self in the wrong way of emptiness. There's like not, you feel so insecure in who you are. And so it flips into a kind of meglo sense of who you are. You flip into this false pride. So you make up that you're wonderful. You make up, narcissism is a made up feeling of being great. It's an inflated sense of self. And it's inflated because actually you feel like lousy. You feel insecure. So it flips to feeling that you're great and arrogant, because underneath that, there's so much insecurity and a feeling that you're nobody. Mm. It's an unhealthy sense of self. Mm. If you were healthy and normal feeling, you wouldn't have to make everybody feel that you're great. See, so it's like it flips to the opposite. Mm-hmm. And it's a very unhealthy state. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. I now get it, that somebody who is so insecure would try to prove and be sort of overtly selfish or narcissistic. And actually, as you were explaining, about having the healthy self to overcome the unhealthy bad self, I was thinking also of deity yoga. You know, the pride in being an enlightened deity is really to overcome this wrong sense of self, the ordinary sort of egoistic self. Interesting. Anyway, so in carrying out this practice, now when you, for instance, use this for treating people, especially people who are going through mental problems, I know there are quite a number of people here in Bhutan listening to us because they are counselors or involved in counseling programs. So I'd like you to share some of your insights and experiences on how practically you approach people who are mentally already unstable in getting into such a practice.
Okay. Well, we would not use deity practice with people who are mentally unstable because it's too easy to go off the rails with deity practice with mentally unstable people. You understand what I'm saying? Because it's too easy to use that as a tool for inflation. So deity practice, you have to have a healthy sense of self to do it, you know. I mean, you maybe could use Chenrezig if they're healthy enough, but it's too easy for deity practice to become like an inflated tool. But you can use Tonglen and the compassion, because if there's a lousy sense of self and there's a feeling of vacancy and insecurity, you could start to cultivate a sense of compassion for that insecure self, you know? So, but we would probably start with just cultivating a basic loving kindness, you know, like start with the paramitas, you know? So we would start on a more simple level first, like paramitas. So start cultivating generosity, start cultivating loving kindness for oneself and others. So, and then start cultivating patience, you know, patience with yourself, patience with others, you know, and then love, you know, like that. So you start with the Mahayana, you know, start with the Shravakayana, Mahayana, you know, and gradually, you know, slowly love, slowly like that, you know. So it's like it's said in Vajrayana, you have to start with the foundation of the house, Shravakayana, with the Eightfold Noble Path, with mental illness, you know, with everybody, not only those who are mentally ill, but with everybody. You start with the foundation of the Eightfold Noble Path, the Four Noble Truths. And then you really start with bodhicitta and with the paramitas, and you build a very strong foundation. Then you start maybe with Chenrezig practice and with the Tonglen. And because the Tonglen for oneself is very challenging, you start doing it on top of the paramitas with already a good sense of the paramitas. And then you start doing that for oneself when they can tolerate doing it for oneself. You know, and then you start with the parents gradually. A lot of times people feel doing it for the parents is really, really, really hard because their parents were mean to them. So then you can't do the parents. You have to start with somebody in their life who was kind to them. So you have to start with whoever was kind to them. Some people I've had, only their dog was kind to them, or their cat. It was the only being in their life who they felt was their friend, you know. So, or maybe a teacher in school, or their auntie or their grandma or somebody or their grandpa, you know, so you just have to, with some people, you know, in Bhutan, it's different because it's not such a fractured society as in the West that you find like in America, you know, but you can start slowly. Now, sometimes, you know, like in the Nyingma Tonglen, you start with Chenrezig above your head. So that might be a good place to start. You just work with Chenrezig above your head, feeling the loving kindness coming from Chenrezig for a long time first. You have to just start, you know, and you can start also with the first step of the awareness and like relaxing and then letting go of everything and just simple shamatha, then Chenrezig above your head, feeling the loving kindness coming in, you know, for quite a while. So you have to start slow. When people are mentally ill, they have a lot of agitation. So you have to try to let the agitation get settled down. And
thank you.
Meditation is super good for settling agitation. Mm. Basically, you have to help them get the lung down in the belly and get it grounded in the belly, because the lung starts going everywhere crazy and you have to let the lung get settled.
You also talk about subtle energies and bodies. I think we don't have time here to discuss those. But before we ask the audience for any questions, I have my final question on Nyingma's Tonglen practice. I was looking at particularly the practice of Tonglen for oneself, and then of, you know, taking the negative energy in the form of dark smoke, converting that into happiness and joy and bliss in the form of white light, by touching the vajra. Now, so it's a fantastic vajrayana sort of technique to convert it, to transform the dark energy into positive energy and then let it out. But this is the sort of scholarly intellectual side of me coming, the argumentative side coming. Will this sort of hinder in developing the real bodhisattva courage? Because what if real suffering comes onto you and you can't transform? Are you not going to accept it? So do you have, for instance, a way to get out of such a dilemma?
Well, then I think you have to really concentrate on the emptiness of the suffering. Mm. And not take it so, not think that it's so solid that you can't transform it.
A fantastic response. I remember this story, I think, of Atisha's teacher, now, who took the real pain of a dog being hit by a rock. And he did really feel the pain, I suppose, but that pain was perhaps seen as empty and was not as painful. Well, with that, let's ask Marcus if there are any questions from the audience.
There are a few questions. One is asking more about mental illness and Western pharmaceuticals, and how should we use those in conjunction with Buddhist practices in treatment? I don't know if you have an opinion on that or not, but.
Well, I have a strong opinion on that. I think that pharmaceuticals are a gift to humanity. I think that they should be used, you know, with excellent methods. I mean, with proper people that are trained in how to use them, and then they're a completely excellent adjunct to good therapy. And I think not only for therapy are they a really important good adjunct, and very, very helpful for, because there's physical components to mental illness, not always, but there can be, and there is in certain genetic conditions or certain conditions where the brain chemistry goes out of whack for certain reasons. So in those situations, they're very, very helpful. And all the Buddhist teachers I know in the West feel the same way I do. The other, of course, there's many situations where, like diabetes and, you know, heart condition, there's many, many conditions where Western pharmaceuticals are a great gift to humanity. The other place I consider them a great gift to humanity, and I've seen this many, many, many times, is when death is approaching, they can relieve pain. And what I found is this does not hinder the consciousness if they're administrated properly, but instead they help free the consciousness so that the person can consciously deal with the approach of death, because the pain is adequately kept under control. And rather than cloud the consciousness, what I've experienced in many people during their process of death is that then with the pain kept under control, the consciousness is freed to then approach the death in a very conscious, present way. So I also think that they're a great gift to humanity in that sense. If you're over-medicated, of course, it's not going to help, but there's a line there where you can have the pain controlled and your consciousness is free then to be very present to approach death with wisdom and love. So that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Kempo La?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think modern sort of biomedicine has certainly brought a great deal of benefit to the human world and also to the animal world through veterinary sciences. So certainly, but then it's best when it is used in sort of right measure and also in synergy with more holistic treatments.
Right, yeah.
Now, there's also a question more general about what Vajrayana really means, and asking some questions about deity practices and so on, but perhaps you could just answer the first part of the question, asking you what you think Vajrayana really means.
Well, Vajra means indestructible, it means diamond. It's referring to our true nature, to that which is deathless, timeless, that which is indestructible. Who we truly are is beyond time, beyond space, that it neither comes nor goes, that who we truly are is deathless, that it's ever-present. We're beyond time and space. So I think that's what Vajrayana is. It's the vehicle. Yana means vehicle. So it's the vehicle of teachings and practices that are here to help us actually discover our deathless true nature. That what we've been talking about, Buddha nature is another term for that. These are different terms for getting to the same basic idea, the same basic reality. And deity practice, I don't like the word deity because the connotations of it aren't really accurate. I prefer now to translate the word. The word in Tibetan is yidam or la, but basically yidam practice. And I prefer to translate as awakened being practice. So that means that it basically refers to various awakened beings that we're meditating ourselves as a way to come in contact with those particular qualities, that particular energy of awakening. They're transformational practices to help us purify and transform ourselves and to help us wake up.
So I think we have time for one more question, and someone's asking about your center, Sukha City Foundation, and what kind of teachings are given there, and what they're even asking about the teaching schedule, how they can find out more. So maybe you could speak briefly about that. Is it in Marin County? Is it where is it exactly?
Yeah, right now, during COVID, our center, we let go of the physical space of our center because it was extremely expensive. We were renting. So we're on Zoom, so it's accessible. And we'll stay on Zoom even when COVID is, when the pandemic has settled down or hopefully gets over. But you can maybe put up the URL, Marcus. It's sukhacity.org, and it's named after one of these wisdom dakinis of the Shampa lineage. And so we have we have a variety of programs going. We specialize in long-term programs that lead people through a variety of practices over a period of, you know, a year or two or many, many, many years of in-depth practice and study. So we combine practice and study and training in that way. And we also have, like I have a women's group, as well as I teach in-depth programs. I train teachers. So we have a whole variety, but the best thing to do is to go on the website and check it out and see what we're offering. So, and we're, you know, open to men and women, and yeah, we're servicing people all over the world at this point, but it is based in the Bay Area, and we will keep doing Zoom stuff for people all over the world, even when we reopen a physical space.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you.
Okay. So there was a question on what the title of the book that Lama Belden has written is, and then somebody has responded, basically, Love on Every Breath, if you haven't seen that message, as a response. And now I think it's almost time, so I will wrap it up, but I'm quite tempted to ask one last question. Are you in this conversation, as well as in your book, come across as a very sort of ecumenical, non-sectarian person, and your Love on Every Breath can be practiced by anybody following any spiritual traditions, you say. I, especially working on Buddha nature, almost to come to a point to believe that maybe even Christian mystics, Sufi mystics, Hindu mystics must have realized Buddha nature, as did Niguma or Tilopa. What are your thoughts when you explained earlier about your experience in the church, and also when you shared with your friend the bishop? It looks like it's a message that is universal.
I think so. I think different paths may not exactly bring the same fruition, but I think individuals within different paths, you know, come to similar places. I think the paths themselves have different fruitions. But take, for example, Thomas Merton, and he met Kala Rinpoche and Chacho Rinpoche, and he, and especially with Chacho Rinpoche, they became very, very close. And unfortunately, then Thomas Merton had an unfortunate accident and passed away. But, and Sitcho Rinpoche told me one time that he, this current Sitcho Rinpoche, was at a monastery of Christian monks, and they were serving him tea, and he felt like he should be serving them tea. He felt the vibration, and they were, had been in silence for over 30 years, most of them, that he felt he was in the presence of his Mahamudra masters when he was in their presence. Anyway, I think that, you know, in mystics around the world, when people are real deep practitioners, there comes to be a place where there's a lot of meeting ground, you know, even though the paths may not all get to the exact same place, there's a lot of meeting ground among mystics. And I think that there's a lot of, I think that there is a lot of discovery of what we would call Buddha nature, and residing there, you know. And I personally feel too that some people incarnate in some of these different mystical paths over different lifetimes, you know. So one person might be a Rishi in one lifetime, and they might become a Tibetan Buddhist in another lifetime, and a Christian in another lifetime, you know, and sample different paths in different lifetimes. So I think that, to me, it's the beauty, one of the beauty, it's like having different flowers in the garden. It's part of the richness of humanity that we have these different paths that bring various different richnesses, just like we wouldn't want only one kind of flower on the whole earth. We have different flowers of different traditions, and it is part of the, we wouldn't want just one musical instrument. So it's part of the richness of our situation.
And finally, now we are talking about Nyingma's Tonglen quite a lot. Can we do your on-the-spot Tonglen meditation in a few minutes that we have? If you can end the session with it, because you present in your book many ways to do the Tonglen practice, and you always give this on-the-spot meditation instructions. So it'd be great if you can take everyone through in next few minutes. And we end
okay, just a real short one, Kempo La. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
We can end
okay. So you can do it with your eyes closed or open, everybody. So let's just call on. Well, first, just let go of everything. Let your mind rest in openness. Let go of all form. Get in touch with your breath and relax. And call on all the awakened beings, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to be present with us, all of your own teachers. And engender bodhicitta, the wish to free all beings from suffering, and the aspiration to awaken in order to help this happen. To come to full awakening, to bring all beings to full awakening. And then imagine Chenrezig Avalokiteshvara above your head, the Bodhisattva of compassion, the essence of all the Buddha's love and compassion. He's seated on a lotus floating above your head, made of brilliant light, his body. He's gazing upon all sentient beings with profound love. He sees the equality of all sentient beings throughout all times and all realms. And make a prayer that you yourself may come to have this profound love and compassion for all sentient beings, including yourself. For each and every sentient being, this doesn't excuse their any of their behavior. Just coming to love each and every being equally, wishing the best for them, wishing they can come to see who they truly are. And then Chenrezig dissolves into light. And he dissolves through your crown chakra, comes into your heart as light, into your heart chakra. And instantly, either a ball of light or a vajra of light appears in your heart chakra. Small crystal vajra or ball of light, extremely radiant. Imagine that this is your true nature, your Buddha nature, your awakened nature, radiating very, very powerfully, luminosity, clarity, and openness, emptiness, inseparable. Radiating in all directions. Filling you with light, radiating out. And imagine your ordinary self in front of you. And engender loving kindness for yourself, for any troubles you might be having right now or have had in the past, any challenges, for any of your foibles, faults and failings. And engender loving kindness like you would for your best friend. Like you would for your child. And then on your in-breath, breathe in any of your ordinary self-suffering as black smoke. And when it touches the vajra in your heart, it's instantly transformed by a lightning bolt that springs out from the ball of light or vajra in your heart. It's instantly transformed by a lightning bolt that then the white light travels back into your ordinary body as love. Goes into your ordinary body as white light, healing you, filling you with loving kindness, soothing all troubles, bringing awakened love, filling your whole body with awakened love, soothing, healing. And just imagine your whole body filling with this awakened love, with light. And then imagine around your ordinary self that who's now filled with light, imagine loved ones and all the beings of this world, just a vast ocean of sentient beings. And imagine that this light in your heart, the sphere of light or the vajra, is super, super brilliant. The indestructible, ever present, your awakened nature, inseparable from all, the Buddhist love and compassion, the awakened love and compassion, stainless, ever present, who you truly are. Thinking of all beings suffering, just for an instant, breathe it all into the light in your heart as a dark smoke. Instantly, the light emits a lightning bolt, which transforms it. Into awakened love and compassion, and white light goes back out to all these sentient beings, healing them, filling them with awakened love. The ones who are destructive, setting them on the path of truth, setting them on the path of kindness, and for all the others, healing them too, helping each and every sentient being to have what they need, be filled with awakened love and healing. And see all these beings at peace, and filled with happiness. And rest, imagining all of us in joy and peace together. And then let all these beings dissolve into light, into space. Let yourself dissolve into the heart chakra visualization so that you're just a drop of brilliant light. All that's left of you is a drop of very brilliant, small, tiggly, small, tiny drop of brilliant light. And that dissolves into space until there's no form left, and rest your mind in complete, open, empty awareness. And now just open your eyes and rest in open, empty awareness. And we reappear, and just imagine that you reappear, Chenrezi, and we just dedicate any benefit from our meditation together to all sentient beings, to all of us coming together in peace all over the world, to all of us coming together in happiness and being able to cooperate together to solve our world problems and to live in peace and happiness together. And may we all discover our Buddha nature.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Fantastic project for the session. Well, thank you, everyone, wherever you are. Have a good day, good night, good morning, good evening. And thank you, Lama, again for joining us. And we hope you'll come back again in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Kamphala Karma. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sadra. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. Have a wonderful day.